turkeys can no longer reproduce with each other. You could theoretically even call them a different species, because species have to be able to reproduce. So all turkeys are artificially inseminated with, wait for it, it's almost a joke, a turkey baster.
Sorry, that's not funny, but that's crazy.
I mean, it's dark comedy.
This is Vasil Stanescu at Stanford University.
Yeah.
How? So, like, every single turkey is reproductively isolated?
Their How's bodies have been so genetically modified for these huge breasts that they can't mate with one another. Their bodies
because
won't
they
fit
just, like...
together. Right. That's what we've done.
Whoa.
There are these domesticated turkeys whose own bodies have now become so misshapen that they cannot mate with one another. What could possibly be more, quote unquote, unnatural than
So we
that?
Literally artificially inseminate every single turkey
That's
with
right.
a turkey baster.
They don't all use turkey basters, but they are all artificially inseminated.
And we call that efficient and cost effective?
That's right. That's right.
How do we not know about these things? And how did we get here? This week, we're talking about meat and food systems. The title of this week's episode is One Nation Under Meat, A Tragic Love Story of the American Appetite.
So we've thought a lot about food this year and about how food relates to the environment and sustainability. There are so many connections between food, energy use, environmental problems, political issues, social justice and economic issues, and ethics, that it can be really overwhelming to try to distill it all down into something comprehensible. A very wise person at Stanford once explained to me that changing food habits is such a powerful way for each individual to reduce their environmental impact because every single day, three times a day, we all sit down to eat. So are there choices you can make every single day, three times a day, that will actually make a difference? And if it's that easy, what are those choices? It's when you try to get to the heart of those questions that everything can become very, very confusing. So we sat down with people, a lot of people, students and scholars and animal rights activists and nonprofits and nutritionists and professors from more than one institution, and we tried to learn about issues in the food system and specifically in the meat industry. The results of our roller coaster ride through the world of meat are what you'll hear today. You're listening to Green Grid Radio on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.
I'm one of your hosts, Adam Pearson.
And I'm Mallory Smith. We now present part one of today's episode, Kale, Cooking, and Conversation.
Here's food.
I didn't have as satisfying of a clink as I wanted. There we go.
Yeah,
okay.
I think
the beers are better.
Beer bottle. Yeah.
Let's see.
I'm Dan Blumstein. I'm the professor and chair of ecology and evolutionary biology at UCLA, and I'm also a professor in the UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability.
One thing we found out from our conversation with Dan was that he's actually written a book about how to use dinner parties to engage people and bring people together to have dialogues about food and sustainability.
you can tell that one's done. Yeah.
So we decided to have our own Green Grid Radio team dinner party to see if there's some kind of magic that happens when you mix thoughtful preparation, delicious and sustainable food, and open, respectful dialogue about a contentious and emotionally fraught issue like the meat industry.
Mm. How do you usually cook your fish?
I usually pan, like, grill it.
Team members Diane Wu and Eric Olson joined me and Adam Pearson for this dinner party.
So what do we have on the table here? There's cheese.
Cheese.
There's bread.
What kind of cheese is this?
I don't know. Just
aged Irish cheddar. And Swiss.
So we also have kale salad, tilapia.
Diane,
this salad looks delicious. What's in there?
What's in there?
It's my favorite things from California right now. Kale and avocados and some grapefruit. And I'm going to make a little honey mustard dressing.
Here's Dan with his philosophy on dinner parties.
Personally, my wife and I entertain a lot, and we really like having dinner parties and talking about uncomfortable political subjects at times. And I was sort of inspired to put together a book called Eating Our Way to Civility, a Dinner Party Guide, that I think that we as a society have lost civility, and then I think that we as a society have also lost the art of sitting down and talking with people that might have different perspectives. And I think food's a good way to do that.
The hummus, the bread, the cheese, the butter, the, what, 4.5-day-old flatbread mystery from the oven.
Yeah.
Kale salad, mm-hmm. And beers.
Every day at dinner, I would get to say, "You may eat."
Oh, that was the beginning. To a family?
Yeah.
That's the cutest.
So, you may eat.
Yeah. Already way ahead. Whoops.
One of our other guests, Vasil Stanescu, spoke about the great power of food in bringing people together and opening a forum for dialogue.
One of the things that my wife and I now do is to invite people over for vegan dinners all the time. And we don't leave them vegan dinners. We just have house dinners in our house all the time. And when people come, and we never even raise the topic during dinner. And I want to be clear that, like, it's not some sort of diabolical plan to convert people by veganism to having them over. I just mean we have people over for dinner, you know, and in that experience of eating delicious food, which is what really people want, it's natural. And we always wait for them to ask the questions. And it's all up to them. They go, "This is delicious. What's the recipe?" etc.
Before we start, though, we wanted to include a disclaimer for all of our listeners. We're not trying to convert you to veganism. It's not our intention to proselytize about what you should eat and what you shouldn't eat. In fact, none of us here on Green Good Radio are actually currently vegetarians.
So we're here amongst this banquet, this feast, and this episode originates from Mallory's ideas. And so Mal, why are we here?
So I ate meat throughout my entire adolescence because in my family I didn't actually have a choice of whether I could eat meat or not. It was mandated, probably just a cultural thing. They thought it was healthy and I needed the nutrition. But later in my life, when I was allowed to start making my own decisions, I became a vegetarian, and later I then became an ex-vegetarian. So when I first started learning about the ethical and environmental footprints of my morning bacon, what I chose to eat became a really important part of my identity and had a really big impact on how I felt emotionally every time I ate something. So I started out feeling really guilty all the time when I was eating meat and wanting to do something to change that. And that later evolved. Yeah, that was when I was old enough to think about food in a critical way, but not old enough to decide what I wanted to eat by myself. Mm-hmm. And later, when I became a vegetarian, it kind of evolved to feeling a little bit secure and self-righteous about my choices and thinking that I was doing something to make a really big impact. But then after a while, I started to become a little bit apathetic that one lone human's dietary choices could actually make a difference, and even that veganism or vegetarianism was really the most sustainable thing. I heard things about local food, and that's where I was when I started working on this episode. I guess I wanted to do this to solve my own inner moral crisis of what to eat for dinner every day.
Part 2. A cast of characters.
In our quest to learn about all things meat-related, we cast a wide net to get a lot of opinions. Something we really wanted to know was whether the people in our diverse group of interviewees actually ate meat themselves. One person we talked to is Caroline Hodge, a current student at Stanford.
My name is Caroline Hodge. I'm one of the co-presidents of the Stanford Food Project.
Here's Green Grid Radio producer Eric Olson asking Caroline one of the questions we asked all of our interviewees this week.
What are your personal views or opinions regarding vegetarianism or meat eating?
I was vegetarian in high school. It was mainly for environmental reasons. And then I stopped being vegetarian because I thought when I told people I was vegetarian, it kind of like turned them off in a way, or it made them think that it was this all or nothing. Either you were vegetarian and you didn't eat any meat, or you didn't care at all about what kind of meat you ate or how much meat you ate. And so I guess I wanted to be an example of someone who was still concerned about how much meat I was eating and where it was coming from, but someone who wasn't a strict vegetarian who was completely abstaining.
We asked Professor Dan Blumstein the same question.
I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan. I eat meat. I don't eat a lot of meat. These days, I'm eating mostly tilapia as fish. I think eco-eating incorporates the idea of eating lower in the food chain, eating more plant-based products for sure. Environmentally, that can be a very good thing. Thinking about the source of food, thinking about particularly the source of animals, were they sustainably grown? Were they not sustainably grown? Were they humanely housed? Most animals we eat aren't humanely housed, aren't humanely grown, aren't humanely slaughtered.
Another one of our interviewees who's concerned with systems of food production is Eli Zegas.
So my name's Eli Zegas.
Eli works for SPUR, or the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association.
I'm the Food Systems and Urban Agriculture Program Manager at SPUR. In our program, we really look at how food policy intersects with cities in the region.
Based on his experience working with food systems, Eli has opinions on why we should care about this and why we should change these systems.
I'll pose a question to you. When you have a small group of meat processors controlling the vast majority of the industry, when you have a system built on confined animal feeding operations, when you have a system that produces protein in a way that's highly inefficient, when you have enormous amount of pollution coming from most meat operations, and they're pretty notorious for poor treatment of animals, how can you not want to change that? Now, that said, it doesn't mean there aren't alternatives out there doing a better job, but the way we produce meat in America is completely flawed. Now,
do you have an answer to that? That you could?
Do I know? That's the pretty, you know, I'm coming up with questions, as you know, is pretty easy. Coming up with the answer.
Yep.
That's the hard part. It's not like meat is going away. I'm a vegetarian. I don't expect people to stop eating meat. And I don't try and proselytize it. I get why people eat meat. Some meat is delicious. And that's not going to change. So it's not like I wouldn't be one to advocate that people stop eating meat. I do it for personal reasons.
To bring in the nutritional perspective, we sought out Dr. Christopher Gardner, a professor here at Stanford.
My name is Christopher Gardner. I'm in the Department of Medicine. I have a PhD in nutrition science. I will say I've been a practicing vegetarian and I'm close to a vegan. I've been doing this for about 30 years.
So we found out that in addition to teaching at Stanford and working in the Prevention Research Center here on campus, Professor Gardner has done extensive research on health effects of diet patterns. He's also a member of the Nutrition Committee of the American Heart Association, and he calls his lifestyle choice an experiment.
And personally, I'll just tell you for my sake, I've been doing this for a long time, almost part of an experiment. I'm just curious, can I really keep doing this? I bike to school back and forth every day. I play volleyball twice a week. I rock climb. I'm 53. Can I really keep doing this? People keep asking me, where do you get your protein? I say, I must be getting it from someplace. Because I'm 53 and I'm really healthy? Does that mean everybody could do this? No, everybody's different.
The next person in our meaty cast of characters is Matt Roth, an important fixture in Stanford's food community. As the previous sustainability coordinator for Stanford Dining, Matt worked really hard to reduce meat consumption in the dining halls.
He now works at the Stanford Design School to innovate creative solutions towards sustainability in the food system. And Matt really values having knowledge or control over where his meat comes from.
You know, I grew up on a farm. We've since sold it, but my mom still has some acreage and space to raise animals. And mm-hmm. So I asked her if she'd raise turkeys for Thanksgiving as kind of a way to memorialize my dad. So anyway, she agreed to raise turkeys, and we've kind of refined the system for doing that, I think.
Instead of giving up meat entirely, Matt decided to get closer to the source of his meat and take control over how it's produced. While this is obviously pretty costly and time intensive, there's really no better way to be aware of how your food is produced than to produce it yourself. Another Stanford affiliate, Vaz Stanescu, a PhD student in the program in Modern Thought and Literature.
I'm Vasile Stanescu.
Gave up meat at a shockingly young age.
I have a sort of remarkably long commitment. I read Peter Singer, he's a bioethicist at Princeton, book Animal Liberation when I was all of 9. I checked it out from my rural Georgia library. And after reading this book, I was convinced to become vegetarian. I believe there was one other vegetarian in my entire town, a doctor, Indian doctor, and that was it. My parents were very perplexed. I made do with sandwiches that I made and oranges until they decided that I was quite serious about this. I actually had the privilege to meet Dr. Singer and tell him I was now meeting my childhood hero, although, to be fair, well, not everyone gets to meet their childhood hero. Not everyone has a moral philosopher as a childhood hero. But so it's been a lifelong commitment.
I was pretty jealous that Vaz got to meet Peter Singer in person, whose book Animal Liberation was a pioneering piece in animal rights theory.
Yeah, it's on your bookshelf, right?
It is on my bookshelf. I actually have not gotten to read the full thing yet, but
it's on my list
for sure.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No.
Guilty. It's one of those books that everybody mentions, but a lot of people haven't actually read. I'm sure Vaz read it, though. So I asked Vaz what it was like to actually meet Peter Singer in person.
Peter Singer is an extremely reserved individual. When I relate this incident in class, perhaps unfairly, I compare him to Spock. He's like, just the facts. And so this was at a conference, a Minding Animals conference in Australia, and he was the final keynote speaker, and I had won an award, and so it's sort of like the Oscars for animal activists and animal academics. So, and he was the key presenter, and so he presented the award, and then I came up afterwards and asked him to autograph it in painful fanboy manner, and then related that I had become vegetarian at the age of 9 because of him, and he, in complete monotone, said, "That is the youngest age of anyone that I have met."
That's a great rendition. And I'm picturing like Spock's ears like perking.
Live long and prosper.
Yes.
Have you met a 9-year-old vegetarian before?
I think the only 9-year-old vegetarians I've met are people who like their parents kind of raised them that way from birth. That's why I thought that was so crazy that he just up and made that decision on his own at such a young age.
And he's like, he's from the South, right?
Yeah, he's from Georgia.
Yeah.
Rural Georgia.
Yeah, and I feel like I can make this almost stereotypical kind of comment because half of my family is Southern, but can you imagine what those conversations at the dinner table were like when they're serving him fried chicken and
oh, totally. That,
like,
well, he told
imagine?
Me, too. He said every day his parents basically served steak and potatoes and salad. And so he kind of ate potatoes and salad.
It must be the common theme among young Americans who choose to become vegetarian. Yeah.
Unless you want to spend your time cooking for yourself, which at age 9 is probably a pretty big undertaking.
Do parents even let their kids cook at age 9?
I would hope not. It sounds like
yeah, it sounds pretty dangerous,
waiting
actually.
For a stove burn or something.
Yeah.
When I cooked at age 9, I like you sliced my fingers with knives all the time.
Oof.
And that kind of ended my cooking career.
So that's why you don't live in a co-op.
Exactly. Still don't know how to cook to this day. Speaking of brutal machinery, I also wanted to know how Vaz, who clearly has dedicated his career to fighting animal rights abuses, actually felt emotionally when he first found out about factory farms.
It was horrifying. And then it was surreal to try to, like, make it through the day. And my very first activism ever was to get a salad bar in my middle school, which I think I managed to do because the school board was confused why a middle school student would want to eat salad. But it was very gripping.
With such a wide variety of perspectives and expertise, it's really interesting to see how all these people integrate their beliefs into their dietary choices and figure out what works for them.
So naturally, we wanted to know how the The Green Good Radio team thinks about meat, and inevitably the topic came up as we prepared our food. So we asked each other, do you eat meat?
So what about you, Diane? Do you eat meat?
Yeah, not too frequently. I have also dabbled in vegetarianism and spent a summer in Oregon and thought that was a good place and time to not eat meat. So I did, and then I got back to Ithaca and I don't know, just started eating meat again. The reason I stopped being vegetarian is it made me think about food all the time, and I got really tired of thinking about food all the time. And I was also eating not that healthily, because I was sort of hungry a lot and would just eat, mm-hmm. like, Eggo waffles.
Right. lots of carbs.
Yeah, like, you know, so many Eggo waffles.
Multiple grilled cheese sandwiches every day.
Yeah. Now I live on my own and have to cook for myself, so I tend to never cook meat.
Is that because it's expensive or because it's harder to cook?
Both, and it, like, doesn't keep as well as vegetables, yeah. So you have to, like, think about it. I guess I just don't like thinking about my food all the time, and, like, if I buy meat, then I feel like I have to cook it right away, and, yeah, so.
You make leftovers, you gotta eat it.
Yeah, but I do eat meat, so probably, I don't know, a couple of times a week.
That's interesting, though, that it used to be that you had to think about food all the time when you were a vegetarian. But now you've learned how to cook without meat, so it's you think less about food if you don't cook with meat.
I was a vegetarian in high school for a while, and I got really interested in thinking about meat and vegetarianism for environmental reasons. I was interested and started to do some projects about climate change in high school, and greenhouse gas emissions were a part of that, and I started to read about methane and has higher global warming potential than CO2 and all this kind of sciencey stuff, and then I was like, wait a second, you know, cows are a huge problem when we're talking about climate change, agriculture, livestock. This is pretty serious. And so for a while I was a vegetarian for environmental reasons in between my junior and senior year of high school, and then I had to stop for a variety of reasons. After that, I have dabbled with it at Stanford a bit. It's pretty easy when you're in the dining halls and stuff to make vegetarian choices.
I'm probably the one in the group that thinks least about what I eat. I like to cook. All my recipes have meat in it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like there's a difference in the amount of meat that people eat here versus in Sweden?
No, I don't know. It's hard to tell. Well, yeah. So, for example, like if you order a sandwich here, it has like 7 slices of meat on it.
Yeah.
If you order a sandwich in Sweden, you'll get 1 slice of meat, because like 1 sandwich, 1 slice of meat. That's like normal, and then you add salad and stuff. But here it's just like a mountain of mm-hmm. meat on the sandwich.
Especially in restaurants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's a big difference.
So amongst people who study food for their careers, and then normal people like me, Adam, Eric, and Diane, there's a lot of variety in how people conceive of and respond to issues in the food system. When I meet an expert in the environmental world, especially in the food arena, my first question is, what do you do? What are your personal choices? At the dinner party, Eric, Diane, Adam, and I had a lot of fun reflecting on the answers we got in all of our interviews. But one of the most interesting things about the wide range of responses is that it goes to show there's probably no one right answer. But if there were a definitive answer, these things wouldn't be so fun to talk about. It did stir the pot and allow us to think critically about our own views and practices. But we've jumped ahead a little bit. We've been listening to how experts respond to the pressures and problems of the food system, but we haven't actually diagnosed what's even wrong. In the next section, we'll start digging into some of the flaws in meat production. You're listening to Green Grid Radio on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. I'm Mallory Smith.
And I'm Adam Pearson. Part 3, a broken system.
I'll pose a scenario. Suppose you walk into Safeway and you go to the meat section to pick up your ballpark Franks. You're a parent, and when you get home, you whip up a quick dinner using those Franks. What kind of impacts were involved in bringing those franks to your table? We asked our guests to lay down the basics of the ethical, environmental, and socioeconomic impacts of meat production.
Green Grid Radio contributor Seet Lally asked Matt Roth, our D-School food systems guru, to lay down the basic economic reasons that meat production and food production in general are so destructive socially and environmentally.
Food that's produced in the United States is produced within our economic system, which is capitalism, mm-hmm. right?
Corporations work to serve their shareholders and maximize profits.
And so what that means is that they will explore the boundaries of the social and environmental consequences of it doing business, mm-hmm. right? And the result of that is that we get these externalities, as economists talk about them, mm-hmm. right, where we get environmental mm-hmm. consequences, social consequences. As you start to think about what sustainable food is, it's, you know, at an economic level, it's really about trying to account for as many of those environmental and social costs as possible.
An externality is a cost or benefit that happens as a result of some activity or transaction, which is incurred by people not involved in that activity or transaction. So in the case of meat production, there are serious environmental consequences that need to be accounted for in production, which affect the entire world.
To get more specific, methane emissions that come out of slaughterhouses have a huge collective cost because they contribute a lot to the greenhouse gas emissions that lead to climate change. The entire world bears the consequences of those methane emissions, but that environmental cost is not reflected in the price of meat when you go buy it at the store. A meat that's produced by a larger producer that has more of an environmental impact isn't going to be more expensive. It's probably going to be, ironically, cheaper.
Right. So in our interview with Vos Stanescu, he spoke a little bit about greenhouse gas emissions.
There was a report called Livestock's Long Shadow that came out in 2006 by the United Nations. And the UN pegged the GHG, that's the greenhouse gas emissions, of the livestock industry 18%. And that's more than the entire transportation industry combined. So all the cars, planes, driving, whether you're driving a hybrid or whatever, combine all of that. So if we want to be serious about global warming or climate change, we have to take seriously the question of how we raise and produce animals.
So we know what livestock production is doing to the environment, but what is it doing to the animals themselves?
The ethical perspective is twofold, at least. One is the animals themselves. In the United States, 99% of all meat is produced in confined animal feeding operations, CAFOs. That's the EPA's designation. They're commonly referred to as factory farms. So these animals suffer horrendous lives. To give you some idea, chickens that are produced for meat, they live their entire lives without ever seeing sunlight and live in cages that are smaller than a single piece of paper. So if you were to take out a piece of paper and look at it, there'd be four, five, six, sometimes eight chickens that would spend their entire life from the moment they were born in the hatchery in a cage that small. And then these cages would be stacked one on top of each other in huge warehouses. So the ethical issue for the animals is quite distressing.
Smaller than a piece of paper.
For that's eight chickens.
That's like my hand doesn't even fit on a piece of paper. It's like, that's crazy. Like, don't we have laws against animal cruelty in this country?
Well, that was one of the things that I was wondering when I heard about this from Vos. I was like, how is this allowed to happen when everybody knows that it's happening? And there's actually a really surprising answer.
In the United States, we have something called the Humane Slaughter Act. But this law didn't bother to define animal within the act itself. It didn't think it had to. The writers of the law thought everyone knew what an animal was. But what happened after this law was passed is that animal was legally defined to exclude all poultry. So in the United States, under federal law, all poultry, all chickens, which are the most killed and processed animals, legally are not even animals. So theoretically, I could take a chicken a live one, and light her on fire on YouTube. And under federal law, that would be completely legal, as if I had taken a chair and lighted on fire. So the poultry industry can do whatever it wants to all of the animals that are raised, which is about 9 billion a year.
That's a lot of chickens.
Yes. Americans eat so much more chicken than we used to even 80 years ago. If I ate meat, I would theoretically eat 8 times as much chicken as, say, my grandmother did.
So not only has meat consumption increased tremendously in this country, but we're seeing an increase in population worldwide. According to the UN, meat consumption will double by 2050. Back at the dinner party, we wanted to chat about how much each of us are eating every year.
There's 60 billion animals consumed every year.
What?
There are significantly more pigs in China than Chinese people.
So it's like 9 animals per person a year on the planet?
Yeah.
I, as an American, of course, do more damage than that.
Yeah, this is definitely not distributed equally. Not each person having
so
nine.
I'm killing like 20, I'm like eating 20 animals a year, or like the cause of 20 animals' deaths for my consumption.
Right, and then there's, if you think about the fact that some other countries are almost entirely vegetarian,
yeah,
then it shows we in America are eating even more.
Yeah, slack.
Yeah. But also, other countries are converging, their diets currently, because of like rising incomes, are converging towards a Western diet.
Right.
And there's been McDonald's popping up all over India and China. So as their diets converge towards the Western diet, there's going to need to be even more animals if our demand doesn't change. And there's not really any room for those animals.
So there are a lot of animals, and to put it mildly, they're just not being treated well. Voz is really passionate about the animal rights abuses that go on in factory farms. And another surprising ethical aspect to this that Voz cares about is workers' rights abuses in this industry.
The ethical issue for the workers is also quite distressing. The workers are the most exploitive working conditions that we know of and have a 100% turnover rate of primarily undocumented workers that are exploited by the industry and then thrown aside in a way somewhat similar to the animals.
According to Voz, workers are often the most overlooked aspects in the conversation and demand concern from fellow humans.
I think if you only cared about humans, you would still be quite concerned about what's happening to the workers.
When I asked him what a sustainable meat industry would look like in his eyes, Voz told me he believes that no form of meat production could ever be truly sustainable.
It's very important that locavores and other food justice advocates start to realize that eating meat is not going to become a sustainable or possible environmental option. I do think that it's possible for us to have a world in which humans do not eat meat. Most of the mainstream health organizations all say that what they call a well-planned vegan or vegetarian diet is not only as healthy as the current American diet, but probably healthier. So it's not something that we need for health reasons. We'd probably be healthier without it. It's not something we need for environmental reasons. The planet would be better without it. And it's certainly not something that we need for the animals, who would certainly be better without it. So as close as we can get to a meat-free world, I think the better.
So while Voz thinks a world without any meat consumption would be a lot more sustainable, we're nowhere near that point right now. So if meat production is here to stay, at least for a while, are there any ways to do it better? We know factory farms don't have the best track record when it comes to animal rights, workers' rights, or the environment. There are places that choose a different system of producing meat by allowing animals to graze and live on pasture instead of in factory farms. What's the deal with these alternative types of meat? Are they a step in the right direction? I read this essay in the LA Times called Give Thanks for Meat, and it was written by a guy named Jay Bost. The basic premise was that it's ethical to eat meat in certain circumstances, and that in other circumstances it's not, and that it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. So here's an excerpt.
A well-managed free-range cow is able to turn the sunlight captured by plants into condensed calories and protein with the aid of the microorganisms in its gut. Sun goes to diverse plants, goes to cow, goes to human. This, in a larger ethical view, looks much cleaner than the fossil fuel-soaked scheme of tractor-tilled field, which feeds into irrigated soy monoculture, which goes to tractor harvest, processing, tofu, shipping, to human. So if ethical is defined as living in the most ecologically benign way, then in fairly specific circumstances, eating meat is ethical.
Someone else who agrees with this line of thinking is Graham Merriweather, the director of the documentary American Meat. Graham was on Stanford's campus a few months back for a film screening and panel discussion about the documentary and the issues it explores. Here's a clip of Graham speaking during that panel discussion.
Every ecosystem and every system of agriculture includes animals. And so a lot of times I think that people have a misconception that if they decide that they're going to become a vegetarian or a vegan, that they're suddenly no longer involved in animal agriculture. If you're drinking soy milk, you are supporting conventional animal agriculture. Those conventional farmers that we met tonight, they're actually growing your soy milk. And the way that they're doing that is they're taking the manure from their conventional chicken farms and the manure from their conventional hog farms, and they're using that manure to grow the soybeans that are then converted into soy milk that many vegetarians and vegans consume. And so it's not quite as simple as saying that if you just cut out meat and you start drinking soy milk, that's going to solve the environmental challenges.
So the author of the excerpt that we just heard from Adam thinks that meat eating is ethical when the meat is produced in an ecologically beneficial, pasture-based system. And Graham Merriweather, who we just heard in that last clip, agrees with the essayist in the belief that animals are an integral part of any agricultural system. Vaz strongly disagrees with these ideas. Let's hear why.
There's been a couple of studies that have come out that said actually free-range, organic cows or chickens may actually be more harmful in terms of GHG emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, than the traditional factory farms confined animal feeding agriculture. While it sounds counterintuitive, the reason it actually produced more GHG emissions was because the animals took longer to gain the same amount of weight, they consumed more feed, and particularly in the free-range cattle scenario, it led to more deforestation because they actually had to create more pasture. And the leading cause of GHG destruction via agriculture is actually deforestation. It's actually the cutting down of trees to make pasture. So while it sounds so easy, confined, we solve it by not confining them. When we go back to those numbers we were talking about, 60 billion a year, actually there's no room for these animals to live. Currently, two-thirds of the ice-free terrestrial surface of the entire planet is used for animal agriculture, which consumes a staggering 80% of all of the land used for humans for any purpose whatsoever. The leading cause of biodiversity loss is animal agriculture. And this is the conclusion of the United Nations. As environmentalists, we are always appalled by global warming deniers because they won't listen to what the UN says. But if we choose to ignore what they say about animals, how is that much different?
So there's a lot of controversy around this issue about whether free-range organic meat is good. Humans need to eat. We're never going to have zero impact. But it seems environmentally and ethically problematic to continue impacting the planet as much as we do now. So there are two questions that emerge here. What should any one individual's impact on the planet be? And the second question is whether eating free-range or organic meats can help keep our impact within this range of what's realistic and reasonable. The answers to both of these questions depend on where you live, how local your meat can be, your access to food, and whether you think it's immoral to kill an animal at all, really. But that's a whole other philosophical episode in and of itself.
environmental issues and ethical issues associated with meat production, and it's hard to get anything fixed because of the political barriers in place. The way our government subsidizes food has effects that trickle down into all aspects of the food system. There's a long historical precedent of subsidizing farmers to grow corn, and while that system may be having a lot of negative effects on our health, our environment, and our economy, it remains. Corn subsidies that were put in place to support struggling farmers at the time of the Great Depression have helped spur the rise of processed food industries and allow meat producers to bring animals from birth to slaughter weight unbelievably quickly.
Yeah, and this really goes to show the power of the status quo and of lobbies. Diane had a really interesting conversation with Chris Gardner, the nutritionist, about why it's so difficult to create change through politics.
Is there a vegetable lobby similar to the beef lobby?
No, there isn't. So there's a very powerful dairy lobby, an egg lobby, a pork lobby, a beef lobby. I would think there would be the cruciferous vegetable lobby or panel or organization or the leafy green something of America. And there isn't. I'm not quite sure if I can explain why, and there should be. They should all have that kind of representation, but it really has been the animal industries that have developed the bigger lobbying impacts, which ties way into our food politics. If you go back into how people translate our nutrient needs into food needs, which is a horrific conflict of interest because the USDA represents the cattle industry and the pork, etc. They also represent the broccoli industry and the carrots, but for some reason the political clout of the animal industry is much higher.
At the American Meat film screening event on campus that we mentioned a little while ago, Stanford professors also put the issues with the meat industry into a policy context.
Rosamond Naylor is the director of the Center for Food Security and the Environment and a professor of environmental earth system science.
So in this next clip, they speak about the current state of the Farm Bill, the power of agriculture lobbies, and the possibilities for change to overcome these barriers.
You have to look at it as this very long history of U.S. policy that has led to where we are right now. And unfortunately, the commodity programs have been so long and entrenched in our political system on the Hill. There's representation from these certain locations that you're talking about, Iowa and so forth, that are way overrepresented relative to the population there. There's a disproportionate representation on the Hill that just keeps the process going. So somehow it's not just the policy. It's not just saying let's get rid of subsidies. It's changing actually the political process that's leading to those decisions, farm bill after farm bill after farm bill.
Our country is subsidizing this in an ongoing manner, and so we are basically paying more and more every year to give the farmers like this sort of predicted level of profit. And so with climate change, we're going to be, as a country, subsidizing more and more for keeping the prices artificially low for meat. It's going to be a positive feedback loop where everything gets more and more expensive, and we're not going to be paying the full cost of meat, and we're never going to understand the full consequences and environmental costs of meat because of this.
Lately, we've seen producer subsidies going down because prices have been so high, but as soon as prices sink, the subsidies will go up, and they're going to corn farmers and soy farmers. You know, they're going to support the overall system. I'll be surprised if there's revolutionary changes in the Farm Bill.
A common thread amongst the discussions we had with our interviewees is that we really need a stronger coalition of people fighting for change in the food industry in Congress.
Consumers and taxpayers haven't really cared about agriculture and haven't really coalesced around these issues before, so you have a very poorly organized consumer taxpayer base around these agricultural issues. They just aren't aware of it, really. And a very highly organized commodity set of producers that are represented by commodity groups, Corn Association of America and so forth, or Archer Daniel Midlands. So the best that we could do is, as consumers and taxpayers, get a little bit more organized about understanding the Farm Bill and have a set stance that we can put our own legislation up.
So individual choice on a day-to-day basis is really important. But without political change, the power of the individual actor is really limited by these institutional barriers around us. Here's Dan Blumstein.
As an environmentalist, I find, you know, you're supposed not to paint doom and gloom. But, I mean, it's quite frustrating that we're going to need to be shaken before we change. But if we don't change what we're doing in some serious ways real soon, we lose options. And that's frustrating. So it's sort of frustrating to see this slow-motion train wreck happening, and know that there are things that could be done, could be tried, could be explored, and if there's no political will to do them, that's quite sad.
So we've talked a lot about different issues today, from environment to ethics to politics, that are complicating our food systems, and it's no surprise to us that on the media, on TV today, we don't get the right information. It's all diluted. In the face of all this confusion, sometimes people give up, and it's easy to understand why.
The system really, as I was saying, it's not designed for transparency. So even if you had this fundamental belief in something about mm-hmm. the system, it's very difficult as a consumer to, first of all, to find it, but then also to believe that what's being told to you is actually the case. So there's this, there's mm-hmm. that fundamental disconnect also that I think just breeds a certain level of suspicion among consumers.
When I talked to Vaz, he had a similar opinion about the difficulty of getting real, accurate information.
Everyone has an agenda. Getting accurate information is always difficult. And then how do you make these decisions? So, again, that's why I emphasize not individual guilt, but collective action. And collective action that requires accurate, real information. Regardless of what we may agree or disagree on, I think everyone can agree at least that we should be able to know what's going on.
Because accurate information is so difficult to come by, there's confusion about how food is produced, where it comes from, what we should eat to be more sustainable, and what we should eat to be healthier. One really strange quality of the American food system is the huge disconnect between how much meat people really need to eat and how much meat we actually eat in practice.
The protein myth that happens in America. So we all seem to have embedded in our psyches that you have to get a lot of protein to thrive and be happy. A common misconception is that we have these recommended daily allowances. A lot of people vaguely know what they are. For an adult woman or man, it's in the range of 50 to 60 grams of protein a day. They're all worried about where they're going to get those 50 or 60 grams. And really, the estimated average requirement for individuals is much less. It's more like 35 or 40 grams of protein. And they add a couple of standard deviations on as a public health approach, just to make sure there's a buffer. And then the interesting thing is most women get 70 or 80 grams a day, and most men get 100 or 120 grams a day. So there's a buffer on the buffer. There's a lot of protein in beef, which seems to make a lot of people happy and think they're doing the right thing. But we don't need that much protein. Any extra protein you eat gets broken down to carbs and fats. None of us have a place to store protein in our body to save for another day.
The protein craze is really interesting. We see it in diets like Atkins and the Paleo diet. And a lot of them say that if you eat lean protein and few carbs, you'll gain muscle and lose fat. But according to Professor Gardner, it's all the same once it gets broken down into your body in terms of how it gets stored. Protein is the same carbon backbone that you need to make a carb or a fat. It just has an ammonia group that you can break off. Your body has to excrete that through the kidneys, and then just uses the carbon chain to make fat and carbs out of that protein anyway. So eating more protein than your body needs doesn't actually do anything to change the composition of your body. It doesn't do anyone any good.
You can What is your opinion of the argument that many people make that humans are designed to eat meat, that based on our evolutionary history, we need it?
Well, it's great that you raised that because you referenced earlier Michael Pollan's work, The Omnivore's Dilemma, and has omnivore in the title. But he has a very particular interpretation of omnivore. The reality is we are omnivores, which means we get to choose. We can eat meat. We cannot eat meat. His interpretation of omnivore is that we have to eat meat. So yes, of course we're omnivores, which means we have the evolutionary ability to eat meat. No one's denying that. But they are incorrect if they argue that means that we have to eat meat. We don't.
One, two, three, four.
You've been tuning into Green Grid Radio, and this week's episode is called One Nation Under Meat, a tragic love story of the American appetite. Next week, we'll be back, and we'll return to the dinner party and wade even deeper into the American food system. We've seen the symptoms and sputtering exhaust of a broken machine that is the American food web. But how did we get here? And how can we address these issues?
I'm Mallory Smith.
And I'm Adam Pearson.
Make sure to tune back in next Thursday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM for the second half of the series. This episode was produced with help from Green Grid Radio team members Eric Olsund, Diane Wu, and Seetlali Sandoval. Special thanks to all of our interviewees, Matt Roth, Caroline Hodge, Eli Zegas, Dan Bloomstein, Christopher Gardner, and Vasil Stonescu.